A little idle chatter about the people that we know. And though it doesn't matter, is there a different way of saying hello?
You're listening to a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To subscribe to this podcast, visit www.questformeaning.org or search for Church of the Larger Fellowship in the iTunes Store.
It's all about connections, tell you anywhere you go. A little unexpected.
Good morning and welcome to The View. I'm Joanna Fontaine Crawford. I'm here in Austin, Texas. And my normal co-host, the Reverend Meg Riley, is on sabbatical, I believe, traveling around the country. I'm interested in following her explorations and adventures. But first, let me have our regulars introduce themselves.
Hi, I'm Hank Purse. I am I'm right here in lovely Medford, Massachusetts, where it is sunny and cool. It's nice.
Yay, I'm Aisha Hauser, and I'm in Seattle, and it's overcast and cool.
Glad to have you here. And later on in the show, we will be introducing our special guest. You do see one of them right there, Deborah Pope Lance.
Hello.
And welcome. Slim Moon is behind the chalice there, and he's trying to get Gail Seavey onto the call. But first, let me give Deborah's more formal introduction than just someone who likes arts and New England. I know her as, by reputation, as the person that when you find out that there has been sexual misconduct in the congregation you're serving, she's the person that you call. Deborah Pope Lance is a consultant to clergy and congregations on clergy misconduct and the cost on congregations and ministries. She's also a long-term parish and interim minister, as well as a so the whole gamut. Mm-hmm. How long specifically, because what we're talking about today is this issue of ministerial misconduct. When did that become something that you began learning about and becoming an expert in?
1964, actually. I was sitting at my uncle's house in New Jersey. And listening to my parents and my uncle and aunt discuss how the minister at their UU church there had run off with the choir director. That was 1964. I wouldn't have said that if you'd asked me that 30 years ago, but I realized looking back now that that's actually when my awareness of it as a phenomena happened. It's only in about 1980 that I began to really think about it. I was serving a church in New Jersey. Actually, I left that church and went into private practice as a therapist, working for a counseling agency that was part of the med school at Penn. And I decided I would hide the fact, or not forward the fact, that I was a minister, but just put, I think I had an STM by that time. You had to put your degree on the door. And I didn't put MDiv, I put STM, which we all know means I'm a minister, but nobody else did. And my first two patients assigned to me were women who were having sexual relationships with their ministers. So it's like, I can't get away from this stuff.
Wow,
that was early 80s. It really became an issue in the UU universe about 86, 87, 88, 89, when the first of the conduct unbecoming cases drew the attentions of the association. And I was then part of the Ministerial Sisterhood, the UU Women Ministers group, and as was designated to write the petition to ask the UUA to be resolute in their response. So that was 87. And about around then, I've started actually working in both Unitarian Universalist contexts and Episcopal, Congregational, Baptist, Presbyterian, Methodist, clergy and congregations around this. And I've never served a congregation that was previously misconducted. And actually, I served one that was misconducted after me. It was the subject of UU World article in winter issue 1993. So, I've been at it a while, actually.
Right. And to be clear, I assume clergy misconduct was an issue before the 80s. It was just no one talked about it. No one thought it was an issue.
No one named the behavior as unethical or misconduct. Actually, in the 80s, when the UU Ministers Association first drafted a sexual ethics policy, at that time, the first denomination in North America to do so, the thought was, we don't need this, it doesn't happen. I mean, the reason all the ethics guidelines don't have anything on sexuality is because, of course, a minister would never engage in this behavior. But in fact, it happens in every time. Cotton Mather Jr. Was caught on the second floor many a time with ladies of his congregation, the second floor of their house, and his excuse was he was looking at furniture. He was eventually removed, much to the chagrin of his more famous father, Cotton Mather. Cynthia Grant Tucker's lovely book, No Silent Witness, which recounts the Eliots who were ministers from the perspective of the letters the women Eliots wrote to each other, recounts in the early years of Starr King, how the minister in Berkeley, who was also on the board there, engaged in misconduct with the wife of a colleague who was his parishioner. So, I mean, that's 105, 6 years ago. Cotton Mather, help me here, Hank. How long ago was that?
Oh, muted me.
That was sorry. So it would have been 17, it would have been 18th century, but you know, so like, you know, 250, you know, at least. Yeah. So
yeah. Deborah, can you kind of give an explanation, a definition of what clergy sexual misconduct is? Because I think that we are even today still dealing with some misconceptions about it, and some ideas that, oh, there's clergy sexual misconduct and there's clergy having an affair, like they're two different things.
Clergy misconduct happens in the context of a minister's professional responsibilities and work. It is sexualizing, one type of misconduct is sexualizing a pastoral relationship. And in fact, that's what the UU minister guidelines now say around sexuality is I will not sexualize a relationship with a person I serve as minister. A minister having an affair is something else. It's a sexual relationship with someone outside the church.
Right. But I think a lot of times there have been affairs within the church that were not, you know, we have, I mean, like any sort of sexual violence, we have this kind of stereotypical idea, and churches have not always identified this as being misconduct. Is that what you've seen?
I think they still don't understand entirely what it is. And I think it's one of the strategies for kind of getting off the hook, not being held accountable, is if you can make your behavior look like it was something else. So for example, we actually have a colleague who has been brought up on 3 separate complaints over the course of multiple decade career. And each time he's been able to respond to the being told of the allegations by the woman by putting his hand to his forehead and going, how could I not have realized that she was that crazy? You know, that this is a woman in his congregation who he extended pastoral care to, and she, and of course he had sexualized the relationship beginning with a grooming and all the way to, in fact, sexual intercourse. But he was able to display it each time as his underestimating the severity of her pastoral needs and mental health.
Tell me a little bit about the issue of consent. One thing in Texas, the law is actually really clear on this because
it's one of the great states. Mm-hmm.
If you are in any type of counseling or ministerial relationship, the other person lacks the capacity to give
That's consent. True.
Can you speak a little about that?
28 states actually have specific statutes that apply to ministers in either in a counseling capacity or in their pastoral capacity. Texas and Minnesota are the clearest. They actually, you don't have to be in a counseling relationship in Texas. You just have to be in a ministerial relationship. And it is unlawful to engage in sexualized behavior with that person. The trouble is, of course, very rarely is that adjudicated. I actually talked to the legal counsel in a denomination that shall remain nameless, not ours, by the way, about a case in Texas that was a clear violation of the state statute. And he chuckled and said, no, a prosecutor is going to bother, you know. Nobody's going to care. Nobody's going to prosecute a minister in Texas for violation of that statute. I think he's probably right.
Well, and I think there's even, the question of, because that, if you say that, like criminal proceedings, if you put that at one end of circumstances, and you put simply how a congregation is going to react to it, you know, as being another part of the spectrum. I mean, it seems like that even getting congregations to react to those with judgment. Is that a challenge? Is it still a challenge?
Yes, it is. It has been a challenge. In fact, what happens in a congregation when the misconduct of their minister is disclosed is usually a serious conflict and disagreement about what it is and what its consequences should be. In the 80s, was it the 80s? No, it was the 90s. A temperature-taking team was occasionally sent out to congregations in the aftermath of misconduct's disclosure. And they would talk to lots of people and trying to help the congregation understand what was wrong, why were they in such a big mess. And they came back and said, oh, it's because you disagree on the ethics of the behavior in question. And what usually happens in the absence of agreement is no accountability. What's really changed in the last 5 years is that the UU Ministers Association has changed their guidelines and been so clear that it is misconduct. And that has shifted the conversation. We're no longer arguing about whether a sexual relationship with a person you serve in ministry is unethical. It is. As it is in 28, it's unlawful in 28 states, but it's unethical, clearly unethical in the UU Ministers Association.
So I'm part of Lareda. I'm not a minister, but one of the things that we are invited to is the Berry Street Lecture during professional days at mm-hmm. General Assembly. And this year, unfortunately, Reverend Gail Seavey will not be joining us, but she gave a powerful, emotional lecture about this. And what I witnessed, and I had a close minister friend of mine turn to me and say, there is a lot of pain in this room. And even the rest of GA, what I noticed is, there needed to be pastoral care for a lot of ministers. So even though, my question is, even though the UUMA has recognized and put in the code of conduct and ethics that this is clearly unethical, it felt to me, and I'm a social worker, so my background, I have an MSW, is in that, it felt to me that it was still a huge elephant in the room that has not been discussed or dealt with or engaged with in a meaningful way. Evidenced by how much pain and how much repercussions have happened since the Barry Street?
I think it's a different, I think that in many ways that's true, but I also think that certainly from when I was in seminary 20 years ago, we were, you know, from the get-go, where it sort of said, you know, like, this can't happen. We have to change this the culture of our system, and I think it has changed. It's not perfect. Obviously, you know, people who were in seminary before us are, you know, that might still be happening, and certainly people who came after us, there's still misconduct. But I think that same that level and that intensity, and also just the I think a lot of ministers sort of thought that this was part of the privileges of ministry. You know, you get a Red Sox pass, you get a you know, cheaper tickets on the airplanes, and you get a mistress. You know, and I think like that that's changed. That people realize that that they're not going to necessarily get away with it and that people are going to talk about it. You know, so I think that's what's changed.
I think the thing that's changed for me is the recognition of the significant adverse impact on congregations and on subsequent ministries when misconduct has occurred in the history of a congregation. That has long not been recognized. So if we are minimizing and denying the impact, it's hard to recognize the behavior as something we shouldn't do. So one way to understand clergy misconduct is to understand it as behavior which is abusive and hurtful. And those behaviors, lots of behaviors which aren't sexual, but which are interpersonal and relational, and happen in the ministerial contexts, are also abusive and harmful. So understanding that impact has really changed the conversation. Which is what I talked about in my Barry Street in 2011, which is how we need to address this self-inflicted wound. Actually, you know, we have allowed this to happen by not recognizing the harm that misconduct causes, and it's time we did. Or our profession and our congregations are all going to die, which would be a terrible thing. Gail's Barry Street this year talked about the culture of secrecy and denial, which has not only denied that impact, but also failed in that denial to hold anyone accountable, even though they are publicly saying they are. They still are not adequately holding people accountable. And she talked very personally about her own experience. And in fact, that was her criteria for what she talked about. Do I know this firsthand? Her experience of coming to understand how extensive was that culture of secrecy and denial, and reported on the work that she and the congregations that she has served, the lay leadership in the congregations, have on the work that they've done to make sense of this part of their history, to address the trauma to both individuals and congregations that they've experienced, and to move on in a healthier manner. So that was very deeply moving for a lot of people, many who didn't know that this was part of what went on in our institutions, either as congregations or as a larger institution.
Right. I have seen sexual misconduct by a minister in my own family. It was not UU. And so I've seen, you know, the divorce, the effect on his daughters, etc. What has been, and amazingly, when I went to my husband and said, I want to be a minister, he didn't say, oh, you can be anything but that, after having gone through that with his family. What are some of these effects that it has on congregations? One of the things that has been so startling to me as I've heard about it from colleagues is how this can affect a congregation decades later.
Yeah. It's unclear why some are more affected than others. There are congregations that have had multiple occasions of clergy misconduct, which begins to suggest that there are some cultural issues, systemic issues, if you will, that contribute a kind of lack of immunity and boundary maintenance in some congregations. And the effect is quite devastating in those. The effects are, there's an effect most immediately experienced by ministers themselves on the relationship the congregation has with ministers. There's a lack of trust, and there's the starting point is we don't trust ministers. The only thing that ministers have is that they are trusted before they're even known as an individual person, that their profession is trusted. So these congregations where that essential condition doesn't exist make it very, very difficult for subsequent ministers to establish effective relationships. The second thing is that there's a lot of disorganization, a lot of just dysfunction, and things that don't get done. The building doesn't get locked, the canvas doesn't get operated, people don't do what they say they're going to do. Just a crazy-making, boundary-violating system within congregations that makes them marginally viable. And really, really hard to serve, both as a minister, but also lay leaders. And the third thing I see in congregations that make in the aftermath of misconduct is an enormous amount of stress on ministers and leaders who serve those congregations, to the point of illnesses, which were well-tended before, that come back and flame up, new illnesses, addictive issues like eating and alcohol, family problems, that stress gets played out in their families. You talk about the daughters of those your Methodist relative. Yeah.
Deborah, what is accountability, true accountability, look like? What would it look, what would you like to see happen in terms of accountability for the person? So what do you call the person who, the aggressor, the violator? I don't know what the word would be for a person. Well,
that's an interesting point, because I always call them misconductors, which isn't really a word unless you're in electrical engineering. But and recently a colleague who's well experienced in serving misconducted congregations said, why aren't we calling these people abusers? Because that's what they're doing. The verb often ends up focusing on the survivor. You know, what would accountability be? Zero tolerance for the behavior, first of all. And a view of the behavior as an indication of risk. Time was, probably still is, that you really needed two complaints against a minister in order to get any action. It had to be seen as a pattern of behavior, a compulsive behavior that he or she could not be counted on to control in order to take any action. It wasn't seen as a piece of data about a minister's competence and suitability. And that would be zero tolerance. You know, if you can't manage the risk factors and prevent, you know, and make sure that you don't abuse another person in the course of doing your work, then you can't be put in service. So that would be what accountability looked like to me.
So one complaint, like it should not be, because it felt, I mean, I had a strong reaction to that. I know in the world of social work, it is, you know, one complaint is the first complaint is taken seriously, and you are in danger of losing your license. So that is, I had a visceral reaction to that you, it's almost like you get a freebie.
Yeah, well, I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist, and I can tell you the same would happen to me. Same would happen to me. And so it's stunning, and I was a minister before I was a therapist, so, but it is stunning to me that the tolerance for the behavior within the religious communities. that not wanting to judge somebody on one misstep, as I was talking earlier about this colleague who was able to get the people who were holding him accountable to look at his conduct as a single error in judgment and mm-hmm. not an indication or a suggestion that he was at risk for the behavior going forward and perhaps not suitable or competent to be placed in service. So it's a whole different, it has been a whole different consciousness. And I think it needs to be more like the counseling universe that you and I are both familiar with.
Deborah, you mentioned earlier that clergy misconduct is not just sexual misconduct. Can you speak a little bit about what non-sexual clergy misconduct, what is that? What does it look like?
It's relational. It's intruding on other people's lives. It's misusing the funds of a congregation or one's goodwill to meet one's own needs or to gain access to certain privileges and resources. It's commandeering one's office self-indulgently. The behavior, you know, it's kind of like pornography. If you actually put up a video of the behavior, we'd all go, oh, like, there it is.
Right.
A video done by the Faith Trust Institute. Now, 25 years ago, a film entitled Not in My Church, which was written and directed by Marie Fortune, still accurately displays the non-sexual misconduct in its interpersonal presentation. That is a movie about sexual misconduct, but the non-sexual behaviors are actually what allowed that minister in the film to engage in the sexual behaviors. It's intruding in particular in that film on a woman whose husband was dying, going to the hospital, sitting with her, sitting much too long with her, comforting her much too physically, engaging in a sexual relationship before the man even died because, oh, you're so lonely, I can help with that. It's really quite stunning when you first see it. One of the things about this year's Berry Street, and I'd love to hear what you all think, is that some people kind of got for the first time, you know, ick, this happens. Mm-hmm. I didn't know this happened. I didn't know it was happening. Why wasn't I told this was happening? Was part of the outcome of naming and describing both the sexual misconducts and the non-sexual misconducts and the lack of accountability.
And what about trainings that we can do or other trainings we do for congregations? Not after, but even sort of beforehand to sort of like let folks know like these are things that these are the expectations we have of our clergy, and these are the expectations we have of our church members. Like, you know, please don't hit on the ministers. I mean, I think that's one of those things that I've certainly, you know, had happened to me, you know, and I know have happened to other clergy, both male and female, that folks will hit on them, and and all of a sudden you've got to, you know, speak sternly to somebody, then and go and speak to people in your congregation about something that just happened, and you know, and it's and is there a way for us to also inform our communities about expectations that they should have for the clergy and vice versa?
A lot of the Safe Congregation work has been helpful in this area. Initially, most of it was around children, but more lately, there's been more clarity about what a minister's job is, what the expectations should be, what the behavior should be in congregations generally. Needs more of that, but that's helped. When lay leaders come to understand what conduct is ethical, that really makes a difference. And more of that needs to happen. Back in the 90s, when there was a wave of action around clergy misconduct. It was, in fact, laity who made that happen. The UUWF at the time convened a task force made up of different representatives from lots of different UU organizations. And it was lay leaders like Betty Hoskins and Phyllis Richter, not the minister one, but the UUWF Phyllis Richter. Eleanor Artman, who's probably the only person in the world, sadly now gone, who is both a lay person and a clergy person, entitled to that rank in both. It, you know, so laity's coming to understand that this behavior had to stop, was hurting our congregations, that has really made the difference. We should do more of that. Part of the problem, of course, is that ministers haven't had a clear consensus about what conduct is unethical and unbecoming. And in that confusion, laity have been allowed to stay ignorant and confused.
In the 80s, was there an idea of what the misconductor looked like? And I'm thinking especially in terms of being male. And how has this changed?
Are you asking me?
Like in the 80s, it seems like something that I've been, so I am a fairly new minister. When I came through, I think we were the first ones that they had actually made it a competency, you know, for the MFC that we learn about this. And from talking to some of my older colleagues, I got the impression that there used to be this idea that misconduct was something almost exclusively done by male ministers, and the whole good old boys kind of thing. Was that at a time, for those who really knew about it at the time, was that what they were thinking too, like in the, you know, 70s, 80s? And as more women have gotten into ministry, Gail Seavey in her lecture this summer was really clear that no, this is not a male issue.
I do think there's a stereotype. I suggest to you that stereotype comes from recognizing a certain kind of behavior as abusive. In the 70s, we didn't even have laws against domestic violence. We need to understand how the arc of of understanding. So we came first to understand that male minister on female congregant, pretty standard heterosexual behavior was misconduct. More recently, we are beginning to understand it's not just sexual; it's more relational. And that has helped us, that helps us understand more variations even on the sexual. There is a phenomena lately of women ministers taking advantage of seemingly heterosexual women who are, discerning their sexuality and very, of course, very attracted to the person and the wisdom of a lesbian minister. And in the course of those pastoral relationships, the minister ends up sexualizing the relationship with the congregant. And we go, oh, well, that's not misconduct because the lesbian minister is single and this other person, you know, is really not married, they're separated, you know, it gets all blurry. But in fact, the fundamental thing is that it's a minister taking advantage of a vulnerable person in their pastoral care. This is what Cotton Mather Jr. was doing in the second floor bedrooms to meet their own needs and interests and satisfaction. So yes, there's more and more of it, but part of the challenge is recognizing the behaviors when they show up with a different cast of characters.
Deborah, this brings us to power, because one of the things I learned when I was in my internship and I worked as a social worker is always being intentional and conscientious about the power imbalance, because there is a power imbalance. And for a minister, it is even bigger and much more public. And so in the case of what you just mentioned, It is not benign. It is not about you are a single lesbian minister and mm-hmm. where's the harm? You are the person with the power. And that's the part we haven't touched on yet, is the power dynamic that for some reason, well, I wonder if it's because ministry is so relational. So that's the difference. I mean, with social worker therapy, it is a clear, you know, I am here to, you know, provide you a service, and ministry is relational, and it can look differently, but there's still the power imbalance. So I'd like to hear you speak to that.
Well, and my Barry Street, actually, that ends up there. You know, we need to reclaim our power as religious, you know, as priests who have a sacred charge to be of service. I mean, celibacy actually in the Roman Catholic Church was established for really two reasons. And I know this is a digression, so be sure to bring me back here. One was property. The church didn't want the priests handing off to their progeny the church's property. But the other was to safeguard the parishioner of that priest, so that sexuality was not a part of their relationship, and so sacred service and healing could be part. We have lost that in our universe, and Barry Street was a call to reclaim our power in people's lives, and our power to wielding that power both to serve and to abuse. So it is our responsibility to manage how our power is exercised. That is what makes ministry hard. Not only do you have to learn the skills that get used in with that power, but you have to monitor your use of those, and that's what makes it hard. And I think that some of that has to do with our theological tradition, our inherent anti-clericalism, not wanting to be different. But we are.
Deborah, here's a question from a viewer who asked, do ministers ever come to you and sort of say, I'm afraid I have misconduct, and what do I do? Or I'm afraid I might. Or I'm single, this person's single, is it possible for me to date somebody? We live in the middle of, you know, Alberta, I don't know, just, you know, someplace out in the middle of nowhere, you know, and this is the only person, you know, I don't know. What sort of, do clergy come to you beforehand, I guess is maybe the question.
Not often enough, but they do. I have over the years gotten calls, mostly from, I'm just trying to remember how many and who. Yes, from ministers who find themselves wanting to engage in a relationship or pursue a relationship. Usually they are single, more often they are female. And there used to be, the guidelines used to be fuzzy enough that you could kind of think it through, like you're supposed to reflect on your power and the potential to and think it through. And even now in the guidelines, there's all these recommendations that haven't been properly updated to reflect the new clear guideline, which is no, you never do this. So people would call and say, what do I need to do if I decide I want to pursue this relationship? And I say, don't. I mean, I don't think you can ever completely be objective or know what the consequences of engaging in a relationship with the congregant will be. And even, you know, the King of England gave up the throne, right, for the woman he loved. If this is really what you have to have in your life, then be willing to find a different ministry to be in than the congregation or that this person is a member of. So I think people do, but I think the boundaries feel so constricting to ministers who want what everybody wants. They want people to love them. They want, yeah.
You know, my very first day of seminary, Tony Larson, is that right? Was the minister at sort of the minister of the month at Meadville Lombard. Actually, any but he gathered all of the first year students together. And he said, look, the reason why we all go into ministry is because we all want to be liked. And it was this moment of like, oh my gosh, like he's articulating this thing that I never, you know, no, I knew that, but like no, I never really articulated it. Yeah. And then he said, and because we all want to be liked, the next thing we need to do is we need to learn to say every day, we need to learn to say that is not appropriate. And I thought it was a really great message and something that, you know, I've certainly tried to do, but it's still here all these years later.
Yeah. So in so many of our churches, you know, they're mid-sized or smaller. There is one minister. So there's no one who is in the church who knows all about this and knows the signs. You have a church that, you know, this isn't something, we don't go to churches and say, by the way, do you ever see your minister doing this, this, or this? They may be sexually misconducting. What is your advice for someone who is in one of those congregations and is concerned that this is what's going on?
I would go to leaders in the congregation if they felt the leaders would listen to them. I would go to regional staff. I would get up on the UU web, you know, Google badly behaving ministers UU and see whose name comes up. I would go talk to a neighboring minister, maybe more than one. I would seek out some outside input. Often congregations where misconduct is happening are insulated from other congregations and from the larger UU universe. So one of the things that makes it particularly hard for someone who thinks something's going wrong is the way to make those contacts is often not visible to them.
Right.
But that's the next, that's the thing I would advise them to do.
And
try to find those outside connections.
And for colleagues, this I'm in Austin. And so this is something that our cluster has talked a lot about because, you know, I don't go over to my colleagues' churches and say, so how are things with your minister? Anything you're a little worried about? And it would be wrong if I did that. And so I think we very often, we don't have any way of knowing what's going on. Is there anything that we can do?
I think we know what's going on more often than we say. I think there, even within our UUMA chapters, there are chapters which are more firmly cultures of secrecy and denial and permission. I often talk about some of those. We colleagues sometimes joke about California, but actually, elsewhere on the continent, there are little hot pockets, if you will, where colleagues too have turned and looked away and not confronted one another about their behavior ongoingly. I would identify Texas as one of those places, actually, that there has been a culture of tolerance and denial that has made it difficult for someone like you, who has some conviction about these issues, to actually talk openly with others about what you see.
And the reality
I've felt that, you know, walking a narrow passage between saying too much and saying too little, you know.
Well, and we're trying to, in Austin, what we are trying to find the areas where there are the power differentials. For one thing, we have a lot of students here, and we expressly tell students, seminarians, and we expressly will tell them, like if I had an intern at the church I serve, I would say, you should always feel comfortable going and talking to these other ministers about anything, including concerns that you have about me. And we've really tried to, that's one way of trying to kind of make it to where people can talk about these. But I admit I am mystified in terms of what is happening in the congregations and how we can know about that, how we can have hints about that.
Well, one of the things that makes it hard is we come to love our colleagues, to cherish their company, to admire their accomplishments, their better days, and to engage sometimes unwittingly, unconsciously, in a kind of calculus which balances out these missteps over here with their great importance to our profession and to our association, and therefore minimize and don't see clearly the abusive behavior they are otherwise engaged in.
We don't have a culture of, I think in general, of knowing how to have difficult conversations in a healthy way. That includes among clergy, among religious educators, among our congregations. This is not only limited to clergy. And it's one of my, one of the things I'm passionate about. Even like I serve a large congregation now, and we had 9 months without a minister. And so one of the first, you know, one of the things I was very clear on is we need to have difficult conversations. The other thing that's important to name, Deborah, is I think, yes, a big part of it is the love that you all have for each other in terms of collegiality. But the other piece of it that I've observed being on the outside of ordained ministry is there is a fear of repercussions of jobs. I think that's a real thing to say, that if you piss off the wrong person at the mothership, the UUA, you're not going to be led to a good congregation, or you're going to have a tough time finding a settlement. And I think that's a reality that needs to be named.
Well, as someone who was told that I was never going to work again in this town, I'd like to be living testament to the fact that you can't. There is a life after displays of courage and disclosure. But I get your point. I have heard from any number of ministers in preliminary fellowship of instances where they're calling someone to account, often even a supervisor, their internship supervisor, has led them to lose some advantage they might have had.
So are things getting better? Are things getting better for us? I think, what about like just in religious communities and other denominations and, in religious communities as a whole, are people becoming more aware of this, or is this still?
Well, the culture is, the general public is aware. Mm-hmm. The high media attention given to the child abuse and clergy misconduct in the Catholic Church has painted, has certainly educated a large populace about the behavior. Are we getting better? Ron CLF talking about it, that's pretty good. And there's more open conversation on places like Facebook. Certainly the UUA board and staff seem to be taking some deliberate steps to greater accountability. So I think the arc of history is generally towards progress, yes. I think that the ministers themselves could do a better job of holding one another accountable and of being able to discuss behavior that's not acceptable with one another and confront one another. I think that's probably the next growing edge of things is. Because I don't think we still have consensus about the behaviors.
Even though
the guidelines say X, it's very clear. I think generally there are people out there who feel comfortable still saying, "Well, I don't really buy that, and I don't really abide by that." So I think building a firmer consensus among ministers themselves is a place I'd like to see some movement.
So is that it, more of the no, there aren't exceptions to this?
Yes, that's about zero tolerance. Yeah. That's what that is. And it may well also be, and this is going to be hard, holding people accountable who have not yet been held accountable for behavior. And that's going to be really tough, you know, kind of a truth and reconciliation process collegially might be a part of that. I can't even imagine what that would look like because it's so foreign.
Right.
Holding each other accountable at that level is not what we have any practice at doing.
Right. Are there sort of loopholes in the process where, like, systemic problems where apparently, you know, people know that this person has been an abuser, and what they have a way to go on to somewhere else where they never have to deal with it? Or, you know, are there any sort of, I mean, like we saw this in the Catholic Church, right, where they would move someone from one church to another. We don't operate in the same way. Are there system? We do. Okay, so tell me about that.
We have. Can I point to something right now? No. But yes, we have.
Okay.
But I mean, that was standard procedure 20, 30, 40 years ago.
Right.
You'll have to go, you know. You'll have to move on okay. to the next church. But it is still happening.
Okay. Are there things in the search process itself that we should be doing differently? And I would say actually on both sides, you know, with the person who goes into a new church, you know, and then finds out after they've gone through everything and started there, and then they find out, oh yeah, there was this misconduct.
We don't talk about history. We don't generally talk about one another. I'm now so old. You know, if your first occasion of witnessing misconduct was in 1964, do the math on that. There have been people who've called me and said, please tell me there's no history in this congregation before I get serious about them. I think we need to start talking about history and its impact, particularly this kind of history. I think Keith Crone has good counsel on this. Just assume that every congregation has some boundary violating misconduct history in its background. And rebuild the trust that is essential to doing ministry. Have that be, don't assume that there's trust there. Spend time rebuilding it, nurturing it, safeguarding it, because without it, you can't mm-hmm. serve pastorally. But it's going to start with us being honest with one another about each other's conduct and about what we know to be the history.
Okay. Well, this is obviously a tough topic. Thank you so much, Deborah, for joining us.
This has been a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find out more about the CLF, visit questformeaning.org.